So welcome to this podcast from the MSc in Medical Education at the Swansea University Medical School. Today we're going to be talking a bit about mental workload and its role in medical education, and it's my great pleasure to welcome a longtime colleague, Professor Aidan Byrne. Hello, Aidan.
Good afternoon, Phil. Good to talk to you.
Tell us a bit, Aidan, about who you are and what your roles are and how we've come to know each other.
Okay, so I'm, I guess, first a consultant anaesthetist, looking after patients in theatre. I'm also got a long time interest in medical education, so was part of the graduate entry course in Swansea, sort of setting that up. I was program director there, and then a director of postgraduate education in Cardiff University Medical School. Now I'm an interim deputy executive medical director in Swansea Health Board. And I still retain some academic interest, so I'm an honorary professor at Swansea Medical School.
It's lovely to talk to you, as it always is, and I don't envy you being a deputy executive medical director in the current situation. I'll ground our podcast in the current time. It's coming towards the end of September 2020, and we're about to go back into some form of lockdown, it appears, due to the ongoing pandemic. So best of luck with all that, and best of luck to everyone, I guess.
Thank you. These are very interesting times.
Interesting indeed. So we will have a brief diversion from all of that and talk a bit about mental workload. Do you want to start by telling us a bit about what mental workload is?
Okay. There's really two areas in mental workload, and one of them is called mental workload. The other one is cognitive load. Just to distinguish between those two, mental workload has a history in human factors research, in time and motion studies, and really came to its fore in aviation and space research. Because in the 1950s, when they were building planes that flew faster and required pilots to react quicker, they realized that planes were falling out of the sky and or crashing into mountains for no good reason. And they included the great phrase controlled flight into terrain, which means you have not a good thing, which basically means you fly a perfectly good aircraft into the ground.
But in a controlled way,
absolutely. And the classic example was that was a pilot who were flying on, a warning light came on. And they spent the next 20 minutes or so discussing amongst themselves what warning light had come on. And in their interest in this light, they didn't realize that the autopilot had become disconnected, and they basically flew the plane into the ground. And it turned out that the warning light was an error. So in fact, there was no problem. And they had a perfectly serviceable aircraft, but they just lost focus, didn't realize what they were doing, and flew the aircraft straight in. So not unnaturally, there was a lot of research into this sort of problem, because planes are very expensive. When they started doing research into space flight, they realized that the reactions required from people, how fast they had to react, had to be incredibly fast, incredibly reliable. Because if you make a mistake traveling at Mach 2, you don't make that mistake again. So the most formalized work came with a researcher called Chris Wickens, who worked at what he called the 4D model, which was based on the idea that our brain, you can consider it like a computer, but it has a finite amount of resources. And his model included things like eyesight, hearing, and touch. And what he proposed was that, for example, our ears have a capacity to listen. So basically, you can listen to one thing very easily, but if you try and listen to two things at the same time, they interfere with each other, and you will have a great deal of problem listening to two things at once. However, at the same time, you've got eyesight. That's a different resource, so that can be used independently. So you can watch television and listen to a record. That's okay, as long as you concentrate on the pictures on the TV, the music on the record. But if you try and listen to a television program and listen to a record at the same time, that gets into conflict because you can only hear one thing at a time. And that was part of an area which is known as human factors, which basically is about looking at the task, the ability of the individual, and the environment in which they're doing the job. So if you have a complex task, if you push it too far, in pilots' terms, they describe this as maxing out. If you try and get somebody to do too much in too short a time, they will eventually get to the point where their processor becomes overloaded, and at that point they will max out and their performance will drop off a cliff. And they do this all the time to pilots. They just add tasks after tasks after tasks until the pilot maxes out, so they know their limits, they know what they can do, and they know how to, they then train them how to get out of it. So that's what mental workload is about.
And just to situate that then in the history that you talked about, so the situations where people were flying planes into the ground, the conclusion was then that they were doing that because they were overloaded then, not because they didn't know what they were doing, but because they didn't have capacity to pay attention to multiple different streams of information at the same time.
Absolutely. Just to explain, the view from mental workload is that the world we live in is massively complex. And it's only simple because of the job our brains do. And you can see that with the problems they're having with self-driving cars, which seems a relatively simple problem. You have cameras, they work out what's around you, and you drive the car into the space between other cars and things like that. But actually, those problems are massively complicated. Our brains do not have the sort of computing power that can do that sort of complex task. The question then is, how do we survive? And the research shows that actually what we do is that most of what we think is our reality is actually self-constructed. We take some information from the world around us, we add that to what we already know about the world around us, and then in our heads we construct a world. But that process is very vulnerable to being upset. So if you think you are doing one thing and all of a sudden reality changes a bit, then all of a sudden our mental models can become completely knocked off balance. For example, with pilots, if they have a problem to deal with, they can very easily become overloaded trying to work out exactly what the problem is, where it is, and as a result, their internal model will become detached from reality. What they think is happening is not what is actually going on, and then they start to make mistakes, and very rapidly their performance falls off.
Which is, if I think about a situation where one might be provided with so much information, one is overloaded, an obvious example is a pilot's cockpit. You know, you think about the view that you get from there, just so many streams of data, dials and switches and flashing lights and so on, that it seems almost designed to make people overloaded. So what was the solution then from the pilots, from the aviation perspective, of dealing with cognitive overload?
They have worked incredibly hard. And basically, if they find a situation where cognitive overload has been a problem, then they will address that either through simplifying the task, making it easier, or increasing the training so the individual is better able to do that task, or changing the environment that the person is in. And I think we often forget how much we learn about the environment we're in. Now, I can remember when I was a trainee in EastList, we have anesthetic machines and monitors, and to when you come into theatre first, it's all very strange. There's all these flashing lights, all these numbers, and it's, oh, what do I do? And it's very entertaining as a consultant. If you say to a junior anaesthetist in theatre, you know, you ask them a very simple question, you know, is everything okay? And you almost invariably get the response of, oh, I don't know. And they'll spend 5 minutes looking at all these numbers. And after 5 minutes of searching around, and they'll look at, oh, yeah, I think, it's okay. I'm okay. I'm happy. If you say that to an experienced person, is everything okay? They just say, yeah, fine, and carry on doing the crossword or drinking their tea. Because the experienced person has all those internal models. They know exactly where to look. They know the numbers that they need. They know what the theatre sounds like. They know that everything's normal. So they can, within a millisecond, identify that everything is okay.
And can they articulate that, though, why everything is okay? I mean, it starts to sound a little bit like some of the classic models from psychology when we talk about, say, type 1 and type 2 processing from Daniel Kahneman, where you've got slow, deliberate, objective processing and then more what we might call gut instinct. Is that something that models onto these sorts of descriptions?
Yes, it is. And the Kanaan's theory was very seductive, as theories often are. And he posited that there were two types of thinking. One was a evolutionary hangover from our distant evolutionary cousins, which was based on gut, like as you say, gut instinct, smell, and it's just very rapid sniff. Does it taste? Does it smell right? And if it smells right, then it's right, and that's it. Fine. And the second type, with type two, is a higher evolutionary, cognitive, logical thought thinking process, which allows you to analyze a large amount of data and then come to a rational, logical deduction of what the situation is. And that's a very seductive theory, because if somebody gets it wrong, then you can say to them, well, I'm sorry, my dear boy, you just didn't think properly. You know, you just had this gut instinct. And it does fit often with when there is a disaster. People often go with a diagnosis early on or an interpretation of the situation. That's often wrong. And the problem is they keep with it and they get what's called tunnel vision. Everything closes in and then they find themselves unable to get out of that situation. And the advice given is, you know, no, don't use this horrible, nasty, primitive type one thinking. Use your logical stop, take the time, think, blah, blah, blah. I am absolutely against that whole theory. One reason is because there is absolutely no evidence that these two different types of system actually exist in the brain, and nobody's ever been able to demonstrate them that these actually work. My view is that what that's explained by is that, again, it comes back to the world is very, very complicated place. We cannot possibly extract more than a very, very small amount of the information from the world around us. So what happens is that when you're faced with a complex situation, you necessarily have to pick small bits of information, which gives you a very basic idea of what's going on. And then it takes time for you to go through the information and pick out more and more bits of information. As you get more and more information, that gives you a better picture of what's going on. So yeah, it does work like that, type one and type two. The difference is the implications for the operator, the person at the sharp end. Because I know from experience, if you get yourself in a difficult situation, saying to somebody, right, stop what you're doing, sit down, have a cup of tea, read through the documentation, and you find yourself a nice logical solution to this problem. No, you know, the plane will have crashed, your spaceship will be off orbit, or if you're an anaesthetist, you will have a dead patient by that time. You have to make a decision rapidly. The difference for me is that if you take the mental workload view, you say, actually, no, these type one and type two don't exist. If you get yourself into a tight situation, what you need is to train people to say, right, I'm in a tight situation. What are the five pieces of information I have to have in order to make a diagnosis rapidly? You train people to look specifically for those things, and then you train them to do things rapidly so that you find your way out of the problem. So as an anaesthetist in theatre, right from the beginning, we're taught ABC. Airway, has the patient got a way for oxygen to get into their lungs? B, breathing, is air going in and out of their lungs? C, circulation, have they got a pulse? So every time it goes horribly wrong, first reaction, go to the patient. Have I got an airway? Are they breathing? Have I got a pulse? Once you do that, look at the monitors. So so Kanaan is, I think he is a massively seductive, and it spawned books and theories, you know, the famous book Thinking Fast and Slow. For me, it's an absolute non-starter in training terms.
Okay, so the practical applications of that, regardless of how seductive it is, perhaps not that useful for us when we're trying to train people to do complex tasks in medical education. I want to come back in a little while to how we get from from novice to expert and what that looks like in terms of mental workload. But I want to stick, before we do that, on some of these very basic questions. You touched briefly on the idea that no one's ever been able to identify whereabouts type one and type two thinking, for example, live. And that's a common common consideration when we're talking about cognitive models. You know, where does it actually exist within the brain? And I guess a behaviorist approach would say, well, what does the behavior actually look like? Can we actually see, say, on an fMRI trace, if somebody is becoming cognitively overloaded? Do we know what that looks like from a neuroscience perspective?
I think most researchers would say that mental workload is a dimensionless and unmeasurable quantity. So you can say, so that's not a good place to start, really, because as a scientist, you really want to measure things. And if it's dimensionless and you can't measure it, well, that's not good. However, there are a lot of proxy measures to it. So if I'm supervising a trainee in theater, I can pick up the signs immediately that somebody's one goes quiet, you see some tremor, their performance starts to degrade, their body motion changes, you know, the speed at which they try and do things becomes more rapid. And there are a whole range of physiological measures which change as well. You can measure skin conductance, because as your mental workload goes up, you start to sweat, your heart rate tends to go up, your EEG tends to change. One of the most promising things at the moment appears to be systems which look at eye gaze. And one of the reasons it's becoming popular, I think, is because you can mount a couple of cameras onto a pilot's cockpit, which can then look at the pilot's pupils. And there are a range of things that you can look at. The size of the pupils, obviously with panic, the pupils dilate. But the speed at which the eyeballs move and the latency with which they fix on items to be seen changes as well. So those measures, so although there's no direct measure, there are a lot of things that you can measure, which put together can give a pretty good measure of what that person's mental workload is.
So we can't necessarily say that it's you know, in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex or something, but we've got behavioral measures which are correlated with a self-report of becoming overloaded, perhaps?
Yep. And, you know, I said before that in human factors, it's the task, the individual, and the environment. And the thing that is unknowable is what the person is thinking. Because I know from experience, if you're in a very difficult situation, if you start out thinking, I've been here before, I've got this, I know what to do, I know what it looks like, I know what the solutions are, give me 20 minutes, I'll be out of this, your mental workload will be fairly low because you think, okay, I just need to give drug A, then drug B, measure this, measure that, make this phone call, get this stuff, and I'll be fine. So you're calm, relaxed, everything's okay. The same individual who's never seen that emergency before, even with the same amount of knowledge, will be thinking, oh no, I haven't seen this before, I remember that in the book. I did a simulation on this. I'm not sure about this. I'm worried. Am I going to kill the patient? What's going to happen? What's my boss going to say? Oh, I'm in a training grade. Am I going to get canned for this? What's this person going to, and do I need to get help? Blah, blah, blah. So all of that added mental work can make the difference between tipping somebody over between completely relaxed and calm, working well within their limits, or way over the top and suddenly into panic mode.
So stress itself can create mental workload that then reduces the capacity for mental workload to take on the things that you need it to. And then there's a sort of negative spiral downwards.
Absolutely.
So some of our listeners, certainly some of our students on the MSc course, are going to be familiar with the idea of cognitive load and cognitive load theory. And that maps quite onto the limitations of human working memory. And the basic principles are that we have a very limited capacity for processing information in real time. And there are educational strategies we can deploy that account for that and try and maximize the efficiency of the amount of work that working memory has to do. This sounds a lot like mental workload, but you indicated at the beginning that perhaps these things weren't necessarily the same. Are there similarities and differences between these two approaches?
Yes. And it's an interesting that they are basically exactly the same theory. The only thing is they come from a very different place and they end up in a completely different place, even though they're actually the same thing. So the cognitive load theory comes from Sweller, who was an academic looking at teaching. So whereas mental workload comes from high risk activities, high cost people doing stuff, cognitive load theory comes from the classroom. So that's a, it's a very different place to start. So rather than the mental workload of looking at specific sensory pathways and saying that's the source of the restrictions, cognitive load starts out with the premise that there is intrinsic workload, which is the difficulty of doing the task, extraneous workload, which is distractions which the teacher introduces into the process. So like things, pictures on your slides and things sliding in and off that just annoy people. And then slightly more complex is a germane load, which is the internal process of creating schemata from the data that you've got. Now, that is a very reasonable, and again, like Hanahan, it's a very seductive application. I have a slight difficulty with that in that I don't think that, that anybody has really demonstrated that these things actually exist. And the problem I have with this is that the drive in cognitive workload theory is to reduce workload. So the what they're saying is if you want to get somebody to understand something, then you explain it to them slowly, one principle at a time, you reduce the distractions, and therefore they can concentrate on it, internalize it, and they will understand it better, which is true up until the point where you leave the classroom. Because when it's presented simply, you can understand it. You can say, okay, yes, I understand A to B, C to D. Yes, fine, great, great, great. And then you can write that out or describe it to somebody and you pass your exams with a very high grade and everyone is very happy. The problem comes is then when you translate that to the real world and you then add in noise, other tasks, things to do, and all of a sudden it becomes much, much more difficult. So, you know, the classic example for me is, you know, as a doctor, you've got to read an ECG, look at somebody's heart trace. And there's a book which almost every medical school in the world reads, which is called The ECG Made Easy. And you read that book and it's chopped up into little sections and it says each little bit of the ECG and explains what it does and why it looks like that. And then it gives you a list of all the ways it can look abnormal. And you read that book and you think, yep, absolutely, I can now read ECGs. Wasn't that an easy thing to do? And then when you're on the ward, somebody slaps an ECG in front of you and you suddenly look at it and go, oh, no, this doesn't look like what was in the book. It's more complicated than that. So that's why I have problems with it. So I know, for example, if you want to teach somebody to read ECGs, giving them a book is a terrible thing to do because it will only get you so far. And that's, it will get you to pass an exam, which is why it's so popular. It doesn't do much good in the real world. One of my early consultants who I worked for wanted to go to a conference in America. So he enrolled some patients in a drug trial, which required about 500 ECGs to be read. And he went to America. I got to read the ECGs, which I wasn't very happy at the time. But in retrospect, once I'd been through 500 different ECGs, having to go through each one bit by bit and write down what the rate, the rhythm, the P wave and the QRS and that, once I'd done 500 times of them, I was really good at reading ECGs, and I've always been able to do it since. It's making it complicated, making it variable, doing it over and over and over again is what mental workload is about. So I would say cognitive workload is about how you design a teaching package to get somebody to the point where they understand, not how you get somebody to perform in the real world.
So the lower level, if we're sticking to things like Bloom's taxonomy, some of the lower level levels of learning where people have factual knowledge and are able to describe or list or possibly explain an ECG, but in terms of reading an ECG in the correct context as a practitioner, you think cognitive load theory might struggle to get somebody there.
Yeah, I suppose it does go much further to what you mean by education. And, you know, I'm always telling our trainees coming through, I don't care if you know what you know. I don't care if you can show me what to do. What I care is that you can do it at 4 o'clock in the morning when you're tired, it's dark, it's late, it's a horrible situation, there's a load of other things going on, your bleep's going off. If you can do it under those circumstances, I'm happy. So it's a very different way of thinking about education.
Okay. We should probably put in a caveat that if you are a medical student listening to this, it's probably not a good idea not to read an ECG book because you do have to pass your exams.
Yeah, I would. The advice to any medical students is spend your time on the ward looking at the ECGs in the notes. Yeah.
So obviously there's lots of work done on mental workload, and in order to say that one a participant in a study is experiencing high or low or intermediate mental workload, we've got to have some sort of objective measure. You've alluded to them briefly about some of the physiological measures. How is it done in an experimental setting? How do we measure people's mental workload?
Yeah, it's difficult because you have to choose measures which work for that environment. And we tried skin conduction early on. And that didn't work for us because we were anaesthetists move around. They have to go and get things. So if they're running around or, say, doing cardiac compressions, that's really hard work. They will sweat because they're doing things. That's not the same with a pilot. Pilots don't get sweaty because they're exercising. So the technique I've used most is what's called the secondary task test. And it's a relatively simple principle that if you have a fixed capacity for your mental workload, say 100%. If you stay below 100%, you'll be okay. As soon as you cross 100% or get really close to it, you're into trouble. But you don't know what the capacity is and you don't know what the person's immediate workload is. However, what you can do is give them something else to do, what's called a secondary task. If they are well within their workload, they're operating at about 50%, then if you add another 2%, then they will be able to do it easily. That's not a problem. However, if they get up to 99%, all of a sudden they can't do that secondary task anymore. So if you measure their secondary task performance, it tells you what what their workload on their primary task is, that on their job. The original work was in anaesthesia was done by a guy called Dave Gabber. He used mental maths. So he would sit in the corner of the operating theatre shouting short calculations to the anaesthetist. What's 3 plus 7? What's 5 plus 10? What's blah, blah, blah. And he showed that basically when things hotted up, the anaesthetist became towards high workload or overloaded. They either no longer listened to him, they couldn't even hear, or they wouldn't be able to do the calculations. And that's why you've got to choose these tasks quite carefully, because if you're in an operating theatre trying to do an operation, the surgeon, having somebody in the corner shouting out mental maths problems all the way through the operation is not a popular option. Unsurprisingly, that technique didn't go very far. What we chose was to basically get an app on an iPhone, and then we strap the iPhone to the anaesthetist's arm, and the iPhone would vibrate at random intervals. So the idea was, if you are underloaded, you feel the phone vibrate, and we said tap the phone and the vibration stops, and it recorded the amount of time taken to tap it. And we found after a lot of experiment that about 1.3 seconds is the limit to a normal response. So the theory was, if you become overloaded, you will then start to run out of resources. You then won't feel this phone vibrating, or even if you do feel it vibrate, you won't have the central capacity to think, the phone's vibrating, I need to tap the screen. So it's a very, very simple principle. I was in some doubt as to whether it was going to work, but we rapidly realized that it was working exceptionally. So we ran simulations with a pair of normality, then a bit of a disaster, and then back to normal. Response times are absolutely flat during the crisis. Response times shoot up during the next quiet phase. Response times come down. We found that during routine anesthetics, response times were higher at induction when you're doing lots of things, putting drugs in, putting tubes in. It was relaxed during the middle and then went up slightly at the end. But it was some of the experiments that we did really highlighted its ability. The best example was a colleague who I set up with a kit and I said, fine, just tap the foam and it vibrates and I'll come back in an hour or so. I came back in an hour or so. I said, is everything okay? And he said, yeah, fine, nothing. And I said, did anything happen? He said, no. So I took the phone off him, downloaded the data, and it was an absolutely flat line with one enormous spike where his response time was over 3 minutes. And so this is somebody, a rational human being with a phone vibrating on their arm for 3 minutes, and they didn't press they didn't tap it. So I went back into theatre and said, well, you know, at about 10 past two, there is a bit of an anomaly in the data. Did anything happen? And he said, oh, yeah. You said the surgeon did something and the patient's heart stopped for a minute. And that sounds bad, but from an anesthetic point of view, it does happen every now and again. So we know how to deal with that. So he dealt with it. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, I didn't even realize. He said, the nurse tapped me on the shoulder. And he said, do you realize that thing on your arm is vibrating? And he went, oh, yeah, and tapped it. So, you know, it was just early on. It was a beautiful demonstration that at that point, patient's heart stopped. That's a serious problem. You've got to focus on that problem. He was completely unaware that foam was vibrating.
Which I suppose, you know, there's going to be an ethical question about it as well. They say these secondary tasks are not sufficient to distract or detract from the very important work that the participant is doing. And so in that situation, a crisis has happened, the anaesthetist is able to perfectly focus and isn't distracted by the vibrating phone on their arm.
Absolutely. And, you know, for that research, we always made sure that there was a backup anaesthetist in theatre who would monitor the situation, take over if required. But also the theory predicted that if there was a clinical problem, their primary responsibility would be to the patient and they would forget the phone. And that's exactly what happened. So whenever a crisis occurred, what happened was the subject just forgot about the phone and their response time shot up.
And that sounds a lot like, I think one of the first times we ever met was you presenting a research talk at a conference, and you showed what's probably now familiar to many people, a video of two teams playing basketball against each other, you know, a team in two different colors, and you have to count the number of times a team in a particular color passes the ball to each other. And you know, the participants, you're watching the video, you're counting very and focusing very intently. And at the end of the video, you turn to us all and say, okay, who saw the gorilla?
Yeah.
And everybody looks at each other and sort of chuckles. And then you replay the video and you show us that while we were focused on the people counting and catching the basketball, we were counting the basketball catches, somebody in a gorilla suit had walked across the screen, jumped up and down and walked off. And once you pointed it out, it was immediately obvious. But we were, if not overloaded, but completely absorbed by the task that you had set us, to the point where we didn't have any spare capacity to observe this gorilla coming on and going off.
Absolutely. And there's two things with that is that one, we think we are really good at seeing things around us, whereas actually the evidence is that we're absolutely terrible at seeing things around us. We only get away with it because most things happen the way we expect. It's only when, I mean, that's a brilliant example, but it just shows the level at which something completely bizarre can happen right in front of your eyes and you just completely miss it. And it's not that you don't quite get it. It's just, you just do not see at all. The other part of that is that perhaps more interesting for me is that when you use that, and I've used that video a lot, is that when you're presenting it, you are deliberately cueing the audience. So you're talking about basketball and you're asking them to see the number of passes made by the people, and you tell them that there are going to be two teams. And I found it works best if you imply to the audience that they won't really be able to do this. It's a very difficult thing, and they'll be a very, very skilled person if they can work out what the right number of counts is. All of that sets up in their mind, basketball players, I need to count, and will focus their minds down and down. And it's really interesting when you see entertainers like Paul McKenna, this is the sort of trick they use all the time. and they use these verbal and non-verbal suggestions to people, which makes their focus shift away from the thing that they don't want them to see towards the thing that they want them to see. And you, if you know what you're doing, and as these guys are absolute experts in, you can induce all sorts of cognitive errors just by leading somebody into a situation the right way.
And how does that all fit then with theories on attention? So the stick with the basketball example, or even with the anaesthetist example, obviously there's an explanation here that the anaesthetist in the crisis or the person watch counting the basketballs is overloaded or is fully loaded, should we say, and so isn't able to process the additional information like the vibrating phone or the gorilla suit. Is it just that they're overloaded, or is it to do with their ability to pay specific attention to the task that's in front of them and an ability to prioritize, say, the patient crisis or the basketball counting task?
Yeah. Again, attention is basically another aspect of mental workload. And I think, unfortunately, attention comes, I think, really from the fact that people... When things go wrong, if you sit down in a nice calm room with a cup of tea and somebody describes what they did and the fact that they missed whatever it was happening, from a calm situation, it looks like, hang on, you must have been asleep. How did you not see that car, aircraft, or whatever come out of left field and hit you? So we have to be slightly careful, but there was... I know there's a current problem with automation in aviation, especially because now pilots used to put their goggles on, their leather flying helmet, and they, as soon as the plane started to move, they would be actively flying that plane all the way through the flight, where they would land actively until they turned the key and the engine stopped, they would be flying that plane. So they were constantly updating their mental model of the plane, height, speed, angle, blah, 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 all the rest of it, what the controls were doing, how much fuel they had. What they've realized now is a lot of that's taken away from pilot. So if you're flying across the Atlantic, the plane may take off on autopilot. Certainly once you're in level flight, they switch the autopilot on and they basically do nothing for 6 hours while they're across the Atlantic. And they may switch to manual control to come into landing, but sometimes they do that on autopilot as well. The problem comes if you have not been actively doing the job. Say you're flying, you're just on autopilot, your mind is elsewhere, you have no mental models of what the plane is, where your altitude is, but anything like that, you can be reading your magazine. If the autopilot switches off and you then suddenly have to switch back into flight mode, you suddenly have to populate your mind with all of these things. Now, if you're a military pilot, you're really trained to be able to go through a list and say, I need that information, this A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and you can kind of get your mind back into the situation really quickly. If you're untrained, if you are not fully attended to the situation, if you lose track, getting back into the flight mode is really difficult. So, and often people will make all sorts of massive perceptual errors because their mind has gone elsewhere. When they switch back, they just can't get a reality back in their head for a while.
So there's a strong relationship then between that ability to pay quick and selective attention and the focusing of mental workload.
Absolutely. And the classic example for me was a study, I think, in Sweden, where they looked at clinicians, pediatricians, and they showed them videos of children. And what they showed was that the pediatricians, the experts, knew precisely where to look. And the only place they looked on the image were the parts of the child that gave them the most information. So when they looked, they extracted that information really quickly and came to a diagnosis really quickly. Novices tended to look all over the pictures, trying to look, see, is it this, is it maybe that, blah, blah. So it took them a long time because they did. It's knowing where to look, how to extract the information from the situation is a really key skill.
Okay, so I'd like to explore that in a bit more detail, but just before we do, I just want to finish off that the conversation about measuring mental workload. You talked a lot about secondary tasks, and they seem to me to be an objective and behavioral way of measuring mental workload. But I'm aware that the older ways of doing it, particularly those devised by NASA, for example, seem to be more about a simple self-report. People would do a task and then be asked, well, how much mental workload did that take? That seems like a very subjective system that's subject to a lot of noise at the very least, but yet it's still a very common, and is it possibly a reliable way of measuring mental workload?
Yeah. And, you know, the common scale is the NASA TLX scale, which asks the person to answer, give a rating of 0 to 10 on, I think, 7 or 8 different aspects of how much cognitive, mental work did you have to do, how much physical work. What I found in the experiments that I've done is that that works exceptionally well where you have a very tightly controlled cohort of people. So, for instance, spacemen, astronauts, or pilots are massively selected. They are a very, very tight group of people who've all been through the same training, and their experience is very similar. And the way they rate their experience or their stress is very similar. And under those situations, it is a very reliable measure of workload. I think we've had great difficulty reproducing those results in a medical population, because we do not screen medical students on entry to medical school for their mental capacities. Cognitive style does come into this. So if you're a psychomotor person, you will learn to do physical things quite quickly. If you're a very verbal person, then you'll like the words. So if you have a very mixed group of people, they will react very differently to the sorts of stress that you put them under.
I guess maybe there's some extra value if you're going to use these self-report measures in doing a within subjects comparison. So if you have an individual do two different tasks and compare the self-reported mental workload on those tasks, you might get more accurate and valid data than if you'd use an alternate approach.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. I think same subject, different situation, as you described, is a good way. The other way is to accept that you're going to get individual differences and just look at cohort data. So, for instance, we looked at mental workload in anaesthetist in training from year 1 to year 7, and what we showed was a pretty much a linear decline in mental workload during routine anaesthesia over a 7-year period, which for me, you know, was a fantastic validation of the method, because it showed, you know, it takes a 7-year period of practice before you get the internal schemata right, before you get your sensory systems right, before you get your physical responses right. These are very long-term developmental processes.
So let's talk about those a bit then. I guess that's, you know, we're going to really focus this on the realm of medical education then, and this transition from novice to expert. You've done quite a bit of work, particularly in the field of OSCE examining, looking at mental workload. Now, talk us a bit about that. And what I'm really interested in is this idea that may be difficult for some, that people who are examining an OSCE using a traditional multi-point checklist may actually be overloaded and not able to adequately objectively rate all of the individual items on a checklist. Is that a fair summary of some of the things you found?
Yeah, absolutely. And if anybody doesn't know, an OSCE is an objective structured clinical examination. The theory is very simple. You just get the subjects to perform a clinical task, and then you have a list of anywhere from 20 to 30 items, and you just have to tick off whether they did it perfectly, whether they did it but kind of not brilliantly, or whether they just omitted it. And that sounds really easy. It's black and white decisions. You just put a tick on the sheet, and at the end of it, the more ticks you got, the higher score you get. Easy. Those of us who've been a marker in these OSCEs will give you a very different story. And unfortunately, what happens is that the subjects often get things wrong. They'll do things out of order. They'll do it, kind of half do it. So you give them half a mark, and then a second later, they'll go back and do it again better. And you think, oh, well, do I give them another mark? And especially when somebody does something and you say, all right, they missed out that bit. And then they go later on, they do it. So you have to go back, oh, they've missed out that. So I'll go back to the original one. And then while you're trying to find the space on the sheet where you marked them down for not doing it before, you, by the time you look up, you realize they've moved on two things. And then you think, oh, well, did they do that? And personally, if you're doing this for a whole day, by the time you get to the end of the day, it's almost impossible. You start thinking, all right, they just did that. And then you think, did they do that? Or was it the last person who did that? Or, oh, and the cognitive workload is just incredibly high. So I was quite interested in this. And what we did was we looked at the traditional training for OSCE examiners, which is to, in Swansea at least at the time, was that you showed them four different videos, two different scenarios, one done well, one done badly, second scenario done well, done badly. You got them to mark it. And then as a group of prospective examiners, you would then say, okay, well, show us your sheets. And you would say, okay, well, you scored them 16, you scored them 17. So, okay, why, there's a bit of a disagreement. So you'd have a chat about that. And then you'd move on to the next one. You get everyone to mark it. You discuss disagreement. And you do that four times. And at the end of that, you'd say, well, you've done this four times. We've demonstrated that you can score these people properly. And therefore, you are now a qualified examiner and you will be able to operate absolutely effectively. So we did two things. One, which was to measure their mental workload. And secondly, was to, because we were using videos, we could look and see whether their marking was absolutely accurate or not. And what we expected to see was that over those four things, their mental workload would decline and that their marking accuracy would improve. But when we looked at the results, what we showed was that there wasn't really much in the way of drop in their mental workload. So it identified it as a very high workload task. What it showed was that their accuracy did not improve, which is rather worrying because these people are making very high stakes decisions about students. And what it was showing was that that training was not adequate to make them experts. They were still struggling to do it. However, what we did show was that there were two scenarios, A and B. And what it showed was that once you've seen somebody do A and you've marked A, you seem to have a lower mental workload and more accurate marking on A. Once you've seen B, then the next time you see B, you're better at marking. What that suggests is that the skills required are very, very subject specific. So if you're marking somebody on examining the heart, then probably with training on the examining the heart, you will get better at it fairly rapidly, and then you'll be much more accurate. However, if you then switch to examining the chest or the knee, that will not transfer.
So do you need, you can't be trained as an OSCE examiner per se. You can be trained as an OSCE examiner on a specific cardiac station, for example.
Exactly. And it's very difficult to get the raw data for obvious reasons to do this. But the suggestion is that what happens is that early on in the morning, each examiner gets fairly rapidly more accurate with their station because they see students at different levels. They get more practiced knowing where the dots are, or they've got a tick on the sheet of paper, and then they become more accurate. My particular thing with that is that I have a problem with the reduction of a complex task down to a list of things that you do or don't do. My own personal view is that you're actually much better off having an expert who just looks at the performance of the individual as a global assessment and then makes a global assessment. Can that person do it or not?
Without necessarily identifying the different items on the checklist that say why.
Exactly. Because if you're not distracted by the checklist, you can just look at that global performance and say, yep, that's smooth. That's nice. I can see they did that. They tick things off. That person is performing really well. If you're distracted by having to think, oh, did they do that? Yes. All right. I've got to put a tick in this box. You actually have no capacity left to actually say, is this person actually doing a good job?
And is that what that map answers some of the examples you alluded to earlier in the clinical environment where, say, an experienced pediatrician would only be looking at the particular aspects of the presentation of the child to look for the key data, whereas a novice would be going through a sort of textbook list of all the different things that they might need to look for rather than making a more gut instinct judgment or an experienced judgment or an experienced description of whether or not a particular problem was there or not.
Yeah, I would say that what happens is that as you approach a patient, you are picking up specific clues about that patient. And I know the example I was talking to people about is that when I was working in a clinic, one of the biggest clues I had was the speed at which the door opened. Because if the door opened quickly and the patient walked into the room, you knew that they felt well, the consultation was going to go well, and it was going to be a simple task, but you needed to be careful to make sure you didn't miss anything. If the door opened really slowly and the patient took some time to get to the chair and then sat down slowly with a sigh, you knew you were in trouble. The patient was not happy. So with experience, the picture in your mind is building up from the very, very first millisecond of a consultation or a task. So as the person comes into the room, you're picking up, how are they moving? Are they smiling? Did they say hello? What's their gait like? What are they standing like? Are they to one side or the other side? How are they dressed? Have they lost weight? Do they look pink? Do they look gray? So that by the time you ask the first question, an expert is already way ahead of the game and is already has some ideas lined up in their head, and then will ask questions appropriate to those possible diagnoses. A novice will just go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, all the way down the list.
And I'm going to guess that for lots of people, you've described from your clinical perspective some things that you have realized upon reflection that you were looking for. It's probably not in Kumar and Clark to look for how quickly the door opens. Or you know, these perhaps more abstract indicators that something's wrong. Is something that you've realized yourself that is a part of a presentation?
Yeah, and I think I think a lot of people don't even appreciate that they are picking up on these things. That they will know, say, oh yeah, she's fine, let's don't worry about that. They won't know why. And I think when I was a trainee, one of the things I found with I was doing medicine, general medicine at the time, and you saw a lot of people with chest pain. One of the things that I picked up on consciously was that when you said to somebody, where's your chest pain? If they took one finger and pointed at part of their chest, they were going to go home, because you almost knew that was going to be a muscular pain and it wasn't going to turn out to be their heart. If their hand came across to their chest, their brow furrowed, and they kind of bent double at the mere mention of chest pain, they were going to the coronary care unit, because angina, heart pain, is a really deep-seated, massively unpleasant, horrible experience to have. If you've had that sort of pain and somebody says, what's your pain like? You immediately go, I don't even want to talk about it. It's horrible. If you've had a sharp pain, like you've pulled a muscle or something like that, it's like, it's there. So that became conscious to me. And actually, I found out later on that's actually has been described. It was described in the 1950s or 60s as the Levine fist. But those sorts of cues are almost entirely absent from the standard textbooks.
And it's the sort of thing you pick up through experience, and you maybe don't even realize and can't articulate that these are the cues you're picking up on. And yet, if you interfere with those, let's say you were asking a simulated patient to describe the pain in their chest, and what you wanted them to describe was pain that arose from a serious coronary condition. But if they didn't present with a Levine fist and the hunched over, then you wouldn't necessarily be doing the trainee justice by giving them an accurate presentation.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan. If you're going to give students examples, then you're much better off getting real patients, because a real patient will come with all those verbal and non-verbal cues. If you set somebody, an actor, and say, well, here's the list of symptoms from the textbook, complain of those, you will miss out on a huge amount of things. And I know I had an example. I was in theatre one day with a trainee. I nipped out for a minute, came back in. As soon as I came back in the room, I panicked and said, get some blood from the fridge, opened up the drip, started pouring fluid into the patient, and said, right, open the blood, get the blood in the patient. Whoa. And the trainee was sitting on his seat, filling out the chart, looking at me like I was completely mad. And, you know, what the hell are you doing? And pulse is fine, blood pressure, why are you worrying? And a few seconds later, the blood pressure plummeted and the heart rate went up, and it was obvious the patient was bleeding. And the trainee said to me afterwards, what why did you know that? Why did you? I was completely oblivious. And I really had to sit down with him and think through what had happened. And the three things which we identified were, one, it was a particular time of the operation when I knew the surgeon was in an area with very big blood vessels. So I was primed. That's when blood loss was going to happen. Secondly, he asked for an M11.
The surgeon, you mean?
The surgeon asked for an M11, yeah, which didn't exist, but it was a very big, long, heavy clip applicator, which hadn't been made for about 10 years. But I knew that surgeon, when he got into trouble and he'd cut a big blood vessel that he shouldn't, asked his sister, who was also very experienced, for an M11. It had been replaced by some new plastic kit, but I knew if he said M11, that was trouble. And the third thing we kind of worked out was that in theatre, the surgeons always have a sucker with them. And if they're just picking up a little dot of blood here and there, it makes a particular sound. If you stick one into a big pool of blood and start hoovering up a litre at a time, that makes a different sound. And we kind of worked out that I knew this was a risky time, which was why I was coming back into the theatre to make sure things were okay. But the combination of him saying, I want an M11, and the sound of that sucker, to me, it was instant. That's a massive blood loss. Get the blood, get some fluids in. This is all going to go horribly wrong. But for the trainee, all those cues were completely missing.
So I guess I'm going to summarize it. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but it sounds like the only real way to devise medical education that takes account of these principles is just to have as many authentic real-world experiences as possible. And there is no real substitute. You can't put in a textbook that a particular surgeon is going to ask for an M11, 2 hours into a surgery. It's just the experience of being there is the way that you're going to pick up on these patterns. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. When you talk to other areas, and I was talking to a Marine the other day who was trained as a frontline combat medic. So he was trained to put in a chest drain. And he was describing that to train them to put a chest drain in, they put them in an aircraft hangar with the lights out, with sand all over the floor, with blowers on that get the temperature up to tropical conditions. And they have to put the chest drain in near darkness, when it's boiling hot, when there's sweat dripping off their face, and there's sand on the floor. And he said he didn't realize he'd done the training in the laboratory and it was fine. He dropped the piece of kit and then just put it in. But he said he realized that in the training, because it was with sand, because his hands were sweaty, it was so hot, it was dark, it was loud noises playing, he accidentally dropped it, but he dropped it onto sand. And he knew from his training that, right, I can't afford to drop these bits of kit. I have to change what I'm doing to make sure that I never drop that chest drain. Because if I'm putting one in for real and it's nighttime in the desert, I have to get myself to the stage where I can put one in without dropping it. Because if I drop it in the sand, I can't use it for real.
Let's go back to the OSCE example briefly, because I'm going to expect that people who are listening to this that have been an OSCE examiner will be rejoicing at the thought that we can do away with checklists and all we have to do is simply say to them, did the student pass or not? And they say yes or no, and that's that. Now, there may be a lot of validity to that judgment. If you make an expert passes judgment and said, yes, the student can or can't do this, or the trainee can or can't do this. But obviously, we need to explain to students why. And they're going to have to be able to, to get feedback so that they can learn what it is they need to do in the future. And of course, we've got a regulatory and a educational requirement to give those students feedback. And in situations where a student perhaps can't do a particular task, we need to be able to justify that decision for a whole host of reasons. How do we balance then this, the cognitive overload, the mental workload overload that occurs during OSCE examining, with the need to have a checklist to be able to say precisely what a student can and can't do? How do we get to a position where those two things are balanced with each other?
That is a difficult question. It's relatively easy if you're in a aviation or space flight or one of those high risk procedures, because the examiners have done the same training and can perform to a very, very high standard. And they know exactly what it takes to do the job. And they know exactly what is required. In aviation things, they do use checklists. But at the end of the day, it's a global judgment. If the instructor says you're fit to fly, you're fit to fly. they use the checklist to support that decision. It's not on a calculation. I think it's a problem in medicine that we do not define expertise. And I've talked to a lot of people around the world who assess people's performance in this sort of OSCE environment. And the absolutely $64 million question is examiner selection. If you have a group of examiners who are genuine experts in the performance, and not only experts, but can perform to a level where they have full insight into what they're doing, how they're doing it, and can recognize all the signs of poor performance and why people poorly perform, then I would say absolutely global assessment by the expert is the way to go. Unfortunately, in medicine, we do not actually define expertise very well, and we do not measure expertise in all practitioners. So therefore, if you may have an examiner, and just for example, you know, communication skills is actually a very high workload task, because you've got to be sensitive to the person, you've got to think about what the next question is, possible diagnoses, move all that around in your head. Not all doctors are good communicators.
Surely not.
You may have to delete that bit. But the problem is you can then have an OSCE examiner who's actually not a very good communicator. Under those circumstances, them making a global decision will be a very, very bad idea. So checklists will get you so far, but they will not identify the difference between those who have achieved expertise and who have not. It will only test, has somebody been able to internalize a checklist, and can they perform the items on that checklist?
Would that be sufficient for us to identify a borderline student, which is perhaps the most significant thing that we have to do as examiners, to be able to say this student cannot do that for these reasons, and the things that you talk about maybe are more concerned with someone who's quite good versus an expert?
I think it's a problem because of the standardized conditions and timings of an OSCE exam, that you know you will have enough time to do that exam. You know that extraneous sounds and distractions will be minimized. So you're actually providing each individual with a very low workload environment in which to complete their task. So they can actually go through that task almost with a mental list in their heads to say, right, I need to do that, then I need to do that. And sometimes within the glossary, you can actually see the students working, you know, they're almost seeing that list in front of them. They're going, right, I do need that, then I do that, then I do that, then I do that, then I do that. That's not real world expertise, because if you have somebody, and you can see this very often in anesthesia, you say to somebody, right, how are you going to do this? And they say, right, I'll do this, 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 da, 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 da. And they will describe the task exactly to you. You then put them in a real world situation where you've got people saying things, the phone's ringing, things don't work quite out quite right, this isn't quite right, the thing, the bit of equipment you like isn't there. Very rapidly, those people will fall apart. What you need are people who don't have that mental checklist anymore, they just do the task. So it's a very different way of thinking about what you're looking for. And I'm absolutely sure in medicine, we need expertise. People who can go through a list in their heads is no good.
So there's a question which emerges from that discussion, really, which is one I hadn't really thought of. Can one be an OSCE examiner for a station or a task, even if we make it as authentic as possible, or even if we're talking about a workplace-based assessment rather than an OSCE station? Can I be an examiner if I myself am not expert in that task?
You can complete a standard checklist if you've been trained to identify the specific things the student is supposed to do. That's absolutely not a problem at all. So under standard OSCE conditions with a checklist, it may even be a distraction, because what will happen is that an expert will start to make global decisions and say, well, yeah, I know they did 24 out of the 25 things, but I'm not having them on my ward. I'm going to fail them. And that's what you often see. In order to make global decisions about expertise, you have to have experts.
Okay, so I can get out of doing any OSCE examining, then, that's what you're saying.
tell them I told you so.
Okay, the final couple of things I want to just touch on then is the students on our MSc in particular. I want to make this this useful for them? Obviously, it's been interesting, and there'll be elements of it that are useful. But the philosophy of our MSc is about pragmatism. It's about taking all of this good research evidence and making it useful for people to apply in their own context. So let's talk a bit about how we might apply a consideration of mental workload as educators. Obviously, we've got to think about it in terms of OSCE examining and in terms of having people do real world authentic learning experiences that are going to prepare them for clinical practice. Are there any other areas in which you think a consideration of mental workload might make life easier for an educator?
I think it is useful, and I know I was less than complimentary about cognitive load theory, but I think it does actually help you design teaching sessions. And you know, I had a teaching session recently. If you don't carefully work out the level of understanding and skill of your audience, you can massively underload or overload them with your whatever you're talking about if you're giving a didactic teaching. So personally, now if I'm delivering some teaching, I often end up kind of developing several tracks that I'm going to go down. And then depending on the results of the first bit, I'll switch to a more complicated or a simpler explanations or expansions of what I'm trying to teach. I think that the main thing for me would be that it's most helpful when you're teaching somebody is to be able to instill in them an understanding of what it is they're going to have to do at the end. And, you know, for example, with an ECG, you know, when I'm teaching trainees or students, is saying, Rashi, well, what you're aiming at is you want to be like a consultant cardiologist. Somebody hands them an ECG and they'll look at it and go, yeah, it's okay. Or they'll look at it and go, yeah, heart attack, let's carry on. That level of half a second look at it and you can see, yep, that's a X, fine, let's move on. Not interested in going through it step by step and going through. So when I'm teaching, I'm often trying to, in some ways, confuse the students to get them to understand the complexity of what it is they're trying to do. So my view is that at the end of a teaching session, the important thing is that your students understand what it is they're going to have to do and what it is going to take for them to get there. So I'm leaving them saying, okay, I've given you the basics. I've pointed you in the right direction. Now off you go. And it's a long way. Off you go. This is what you're going to need to do. I think a traditional educational aspect would be that, right, by the end of this teaching session, you need to know X, Y, and Z, which is a very different way of constructing a teaching session.
Yeah. And I'm an unashamed fan of cognitive load theory, although I take all of your points on board. And it is some, what you've suggested is, in contrast to some of the advice that cognitive load theory would give, which is to take away the long-term goal of a teaching session and focus on what the most immediate goal is, and thereby not overloading someone with thinking about all of the steps that they have to do to get to the point where they can, say, confidently read an ECG within a second, but to focus first of all on just reading, say, one of the waves or two of the waves, or reading the waves under certain conditions. I guess we can reconcile those two positions by saying that what you're proposing is that you need, by the end of a learning activity, to get to somebody, a learner, to a point where they can do a task under authentic real world conditions. Is that right?
Yeah.
And that they can do something rather than talk about it, rather than explain it. It's about actually being able to do the task.
Yeah. And you know, you're right. The cognitive load theory is very useful in design, and it does make you realize if in your designs that sometimes you'll run a teaching session, it will fail because you're just asking too much of the students and they just will not be able to deal with that complexity. And then you have to break it down and say, okay, well, once you've got A and once you've got B, now let's put them together. Let's think about them together. And then you can move it forward.
Okay. I guess final question then is there anything else you want to tell us? Is there any other advice you could give someone who's perhaps new to this area about how best to apply this information to their teaching practice?
I think this is, you know, human cognition is a fantastically interesting area. I think, unfortunately, because the brain is so complicated, it is massively difficult to try and explain anything useful in a few sentences because it just doesn't cut it. because it's always much more complicated than that. The main thing I would say is that when you're looking at when people are making mistakes, when they can't do things, you really need to think about what is it that they're not getting? What is it that's going wrong? How do I provide them? And I know when I've been teaching, the example I give is, I say to people, have you ever got on an escalator that isn't moving? A lot of people will say, yeah. And I said, well, what happens? And they say, Oh, yeah. You suddenly find yourself kind of pitching forward. And they say, well, okay, well, how would you teach somebody to use an escalator? And most of them say, well, I'd take them to a stairs and show them how to walk up a flight of stairs, most people would, start out with a history of stairs and how they moved onto escalators and how they allowed tall buildings to be built. But for me, it's thinking about, well, hang about, no, when you walk onto an escalator that isn't moving, you almost fall over unconsciously. And the reason you do that is because we learn subconsciously that when you step onto an escalator, just before you step onto it, you shift your center of gravity forwards unconsciously, so that as you step on the escalator, as our legs accelerate, it brings our center of gravity back. And then as you get to the end of the escalator, you drop your center of gravity back slightly. So as you step off, your legs slow down and again, your center of gravity goes back. But we almost always learn that as a child. And it's a completely unconscious thing. And every time I get on a stationary escalator, I almost fall over and it's very annoying. But there's nothing I can do about it. So if you're teaching people how to use escalators, the absolutely critical thing that you need to do is to explain to them about this shift of center of gravity and how you need to anticipate it and how you need to be aware of the shifting forwards. And then you can say to them, well, actually, and if you do it with a stationary escalator, you'll find this happens. So what I'd suggest is that when you're thinking about teaching something, think about what is it actually that are the really key things here. Try and talk to people who are learning the skill and say, okay, well, what are you finding difficult here? What is it you can't get? What mistakes are you making? And are there things that you suddenly thought, that's why? Because often I find if you speak to experts, they'll say, well, you just do this, just put it in there and it's easy. Talk to the novices. See what mistakes they're making, see how they're learning, see those little insights they get, watch novices doing it wrong, and then use that to construct your educational materials and say, okay, here are the real things that you need to know. These are the stages that you're going to go through. These are the misconceptions you're going to have. These are the mistakes you're going to make. And then you can provide them with a much, much better structured and better training program.
And then get on the escalator yourself.
Absolutely.
So great. And advocacy for peer learning and for experiential learning all the way through then, I think.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Aidan. That's been a fascinating conversation, and I hope our students will find it useful. And it's been lovely to talk to you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for asking me.